This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. We welcome Beth Hill as our guest. How you doing, Beth?
I'm wonderful, Bob. So happy to be here with you.
Well, good to have you on the program. Beth Hill is president and CEO of Fort Ticonderoga in Ticonderoga, New York, on Lake Champlain, and was also near Lake George. Fort Ticonderoga is a major tourist attraction, history and more, I guess you could say. And we're going to talk with Beth Hill about specific events they're having this year. One of your major, shows this year, if you will, have to do with the fort and the time of the French. This fort was built by the French, and it was called Fort Carillon. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Absolutely, Bob. Well, one of our innovations as a museum and historic place is every year we reinvent ourselves, if you will. And that means that every year we highlight a different aspect of our epic story here at Ticonderoga. So this year, our interpretive focus is 1758, which is this epic year that highlights the struggle for North America between England and France and their empires. Yes, indeed, the French created or initiated Fort Carillon in the year 1755. Construction was well underway in 1756. It was a launching point to attack the British northern part of their empire here in the North American colonies. And really, if you think about this part of from Lake Champlain down to the southern end of Lake George being a no man's land where this constant skirmish was happening. So this year's focus with 1758 really gives us this opportunity to highlight this pivotal year in North America's history. And the British intended to defeat New France, to defeat the French in the North American Empire, and invested significantly in the number of troops and resources. And it was here at Carillon, or the preparation for the capture of Carillon, that the British amassed the largest army to date in North America, more than 16,000 troops under General James Abercrombie. And it was a remarkable logistical feat in bringing his army to Ticonderoga, more than 1,000 boats. And I love when I'm out on Lake George to envision this, more than 1,000 boats, more than 7-mile-long armada of 16,000 men set about going north to take Carillon. Montcalm, the Marquis de Montcalm, who was the general in charge of French forces in Canada, was here at Carillon, only had about 4,000 soldiers, and knew there was a large army coming towards him. And so in just a few short days, built this extensive line of defenses protected by abattis and dropping down on the cliffs that extended this whole peninsula and then prepared for the British attack.
You use the word, I don't really know, abattis, what is that?
Yeah, so it's part of a defense system in the 18th century, but we still see it today and used with the military through different mediums. So in the 18th century, they would cut treetops, you know, about 20 feet tall and create this entangled barbed wire that would then, you know, be put into trenches. So when the enemy would try to approach, they'd get completely ensnared in this and make for easy fodder for the army trying to defend the location.
Wow. And so the defense of the fort, to some extent, was outside the fort.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is somewhat of a I think a misunderstanding about Ticonderoga in general, because a lot of people who have come to visit us as a museum and historic place in the 20th century and now even into the 21st century, think of the fort and really think about the reconstructed and restored fortification, that, you know, incredible Vauban star design fort that we have, which really did sit as a central location. But for every army that was here in the 18th century, beginning with the French, there were military fortifications and defenses that extended from Lake George all the way to Lake Champlain. And as for the Americans, it went all the way into present-day Vermont at Mount Independence, which is a part of our property today. So there were defenses across the entire peninsula and also at the landing at Lake George in the northern part of Lake George. So Montcalm knew that with only 4,000 troops and a significantly larger number of British troops, he wasn't quite sure how many, but knew significantly larger, that he would never be able to hold the core fort of Fort Carillon under siege. So, you know, learning from his experience in the wars in Europe prior to his service here, he went out from the central fortification and on the heights of Carillon, which is that raised hill that people drive through on their way out of our property, and he dug extensive trenches, and you know, there's just great documentation and letters and accounts mm-hmm. and journals in our museum holdings that describe the French officers, you know, hand in hand working with the enlisted soldiers, digging the trenches, knocking down the forest to then create the log walls and the abatis that stretched across mm-hmm. the entire peninsula, which we still have today on our property.
So in 1758, the Battle of Carillon, the French prevailed. The British had to give up the attempt to take the fort.
Absolutely. And it was a stunning victory for the French. And in fact, Montcalm erected a cross after and said, surely it was through God's grace and an absolute miracle that they were able to defeat the British. It was the result of a number of mistakes on the British side and happenstance or, you know, misfortune. When the British landed on July 6th, the very young and charismatic Lord Howe was leading the troops upon landing and got into a fierce firefight with a French patrol. And although the French took quite a hit on July 6th, the greatest loss, at least for the British, was Lord Howe, who was killed almost instantly. And Howe really had the morale of the British army and was the front leader. Abercrombie was less inspiring to the troops, and then there were some other miscalculations with, you know, as the British attempted to capture Carillon. The battle itself was on July 8th, and it was, in all, at the end of the day, became the bloodiest day in North American history all the way until the American Civil War. There were more than 2,600 casualties. Almost 2,000 of those were British, and some staggering losses, particularly with the 42nd Highlanders, who later became known as the Black Watch. Out of their 1,000 men, there were over 600 casualties. And the British, although they still had significantly more troops than the French, reeled back to Lake George, I mean, just in complete chaos, and fled back to the southern part of the lake and went into winter quarters in August. And, you know, the French, you know, were still uncertain were they going to come back and attack the next day because they knew they were still so outnumbered. But it was just a staggering loss for the British. And it really seared Ticonderoga in the memory and in the minds of the Atlantic world at that time as this impenetrable fortress. And the echo of this epic battle and the bloodshed and the loss reverberates even, you know, into the Revolution when the Americans are entrenching those same lines where the battle took place and called it Liberty Hill. And Anthony Wayne writes to Benjamin Franklin and says, we're going to give the British what they got here at Ticonderoga. And it's powerful because a lot of the men who served under the British at the Battle of Carillon also ended up serving in the American forces during the Revolution, whether it was provincial or Continental Army or state militias or, you know, a variety of other ways.
Now, how will you commemorate this? These events this summer? Do you have special programs? I mean, people, reenactors, things like that, or what are you doing?
Absolutely, Bob. So we have a phenomenal staff. We employ close to 100 employees, 30 year-round, full-time. We have a public history department that is led by incredible museum professionals. And we start our research over a year in advance for each year that we're interpreting. So that starts in our museum collections, looking at original uniforms and documents and archaeological items. We have more than 300,000 archaeological items for our staff to review. And then it goes to our historic trades department, where our tailors and shoemakers produce the uniforms that will represent that year's historic interpretation. The whole story arc of the narrative of the year finds its way in more than 14 tours a day. It influences what we grow in our garrison garden, what the noonday meal is for the troops here. So every day at noon, our visitors will see, you know, not only what was grown in the garden, but the rations that were given to those troops and how they cook them in the camp kitchens and in the officers' quarters. The story finds its way into our thrilling musket and cannon demonstrations, which highlight that particular year and the French strategy and tactics and military science. It finds its way into the fatigue duties that our soldiers, our staff members are implementing every day, and even into our family programs and our exhibitions and our boat tours and our Mount Defiance experience. So across our 2,000 acres, there are programs, more than 14 tours a day and exhibitions and programs that highlight this story.
So come to Fort Ticonderoga this summer and go back to 1758.
Exactly. I will say, though, just as a caveat, today Ticonderoga sits in the United States, and we certainly have great celebrations for our American story. So, for example, Memorial Day or July 4th Independence Day holiday and some of our other holidays, we change back to an American interpretation because we have a lot of layers and stories to share.
Well, I mean, and the fort was at various times controlled by the French, the British, and the Americans. So.
That is correct. Absolutely. And that's why this approach makes a lot of sense, because it is a very big story. And by taking this approach, it helps, really clarify our staff focus and research. It is so exciting to offer our guests a new experience every single year. You know, often people go to historic places and museums and they say, oh, I've been there, I've done that, I know that story, I've already experienced that. And for us to be able to tell a new story and bring our visitors into the process of inquiry and how we develop our understanding and our interpretation, and whether that manifests itself into the material culture or into our programs. And so, you know, there's a great opportunity there not only to learn the story about Ticonderoga and how what happened here impacted the Atlantic world in the 18th century and the formation of our nation, but also the process of history as an active discipline. And that's really exciting, because that gives our visitors an understanding to carry with them beyond their Ticonderoga experience.
We're talking with Beth Hill, President and CEO of Fort Ticonderoga in Ticonderoga, New York. We'll be back with her in just a moment here on the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore. Want to put in a word for our GoFundMe campaign, which keeps our program on the internet and on our broadcast outlets as well. You can go to this website, gofundme.com/2019-the-historians, and you can make a contribution, and we'd really appreciate it. If you'd rather send a check in the mail, make the check out to me, Bob Cudmore, and send to 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. And thank you very much. We're talking with Beth Hill, President and CEO of Fort Ticonderoga. I just want to put in a word on behalf of, I believe his name's pronounced Matt Kegel, your curator. We interviewed him a couple of years ago on the Fort Ticonderoga experience, and he's a very knowledgeable gentleman.
He is. We have such a talented staff, and Matt certainly is an incredible asset to our organization. He's an expert in material culture, is completing his PhD, and just has a stunning encyclopedic mind and charismatic and passionate approach. And so, yeah, he's brilliant, and he's been busy working on some new exhibitions for this year, which I'll be happy to tell you about.
Yes, be happy to hear it. But let me just ask you a historical question. We've been talking about the fact that this year you're focusing on 1758, the Battle of Carillon, when 4,000 French defenders repelled an attack by 16,000 British troops. But is it so that the next year, though, the British returned and there was only a token French garrison at the fort?
Absolutely. You are right, Bob. That is true. So while Carillon was a huge victory for France in 1758, the French were experiencing some staggering defeats at Fort Duquesne to the south and also to the north in Canada. And so by 1759, the French resources were really dwindling. And, you know, I think it's important for everybody to keep in mind, although here in North America we call it the French and Indian War, it's part of a global 7 years war. So the British and French were fighting all over their empire. In fact, Winston Churchill refers to this war as the First World War. And so the French were not able to hold Carillon in 59, and General Amherst learned lessons from the previous attempt to capture Carillon, and in fact, in July of 1759, the British secured it.
If we go back to the present day, if you will, I think you started this last year, but it continues this year. You have Carillon boat crews. You have a replica. Is it a replica of a boat from the 1700s?
We do have a wonderful boat, the Carillon, and we do boat tours. We do 3 boat tours a day in July and August, 2 in May and June a day, and of course we're open 7 days a week. And then into the fall, we do tours as well. The boat itself, I think, it's a fun boat in that it reflects other layers of our story, because we also have a fabulous 19th century and 20th century story here on our property. The boat is a reproduction boat from really the late 19th century of a touring boat. Sometimes it's referred to as a Thousand Islands touring boat, but I've seen images from our region as well on Lake George with a boat that looks like it is 60 feet long. It seats about 40 people, and we do narrated boat tours. We have sonar so we can see all of the amazing underwater archaeology along our 2-mile coastline here on Lake Champlain, and across the lake we have incredible features such as the American Bridge from the Revolution. There are shipwrecks. There are even train cars underwater, highlighting kind of the 19th and 20th century history. So it's a wonderful addition. And between our boat and all the activities we have across our property and our gardens and Mount Defiance, we've created such a big experience, Bob, that now our tickets are buy one day, get the next day free, just because our guests see that there's so much to do, and we don't want them to have a hard time trying to make a decision to pick. So a lot of our guests are coming back a second day to get the most of their Fort Ticonderoga experience.
And let me ask you about your interactive family program. What is that?
Yeah, so we're very excited this year to unveil Voyage New France, which is a family adventure. And so that will be in July and August. And it's a self-guided program where families will be able to participate in working side-by-side with our soldiers from 1758. And they'll have key locations to visit and activities to do, such as making a toque, which is a French cap. and helping the shoemakers and working in the garrison gardens. And if they complete several of the tasks, the families return to our officer of the day quarters, and the kids will win prizes. And I think the word is that it's going to be an awesome reproduction gold coin from 1758. Mm.
And in addition to the fort, you've also got gardens and animals there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, our gardens date back even back before European contact, when this area was an area of conquest between Native Americans. But as the European armies came in, starting with the French built their garrison garden, the Jardin d'Oie, and it provided vital vegetables for the army that was here, for the troops. And that continued with the British and the Americans. And so we do have a garrison garden that represents 1758 and what the soldiers were growing that year. And our staff then utilizes those that produce and incorporates that into their camp kitchen and their meal time that they create and actually eat. In addition to that, though, you know, right after the Revolution, almost immediately after the Revolution, the Pell family purchased the land here, William Ferris Pell, and put a fence around the fort, which was the earliest act of preservation in America. But Pell also planted beautiful gardens, and the gardens supported the house as well as when the family home became a hotel. And then into the 20th century, our museum founders, Stephen and Sarah Pell, had a beautiful garden, a colonial revival walled flower garden installed and planted, which was a reminiscence of what was the, you know, looking back and inspired by the history of the garden. So we, in total, have, I believe we have 6 or 7 gardens on our property, including the wall garden and discovery gardens, a children's garden. We have our farm-to-table garden, which we utilize to incorporate into our cafe food. And so it's just, it's such a wonderful experience in that Pavilion Node area right on the shores of Lake Champlain.
Is the fort itself go back to the French or the British or the Americans, or was it reconstructed at some point?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and it's, you know, it ties in with what I said earlier of the, you know, the process of studying history and understanding it and recreating it. You know, whether a historian is writing a book or making a recreation of a uniform or reconstructing or restoring historic structures, it's this process that, you know, of study and analysis and interpretation. So our museum founders, Stephen and Sarah Pell, in 1908 decided that they would restore the fort, reconstruct it in many cases, and establish our museum. And it's really incredible, Bob, because this is before national parks existed. And it has its foundation, as I mentioned earlier, in 1820 when Stephen Pell's great-great-grandfather, William Ferris Pell, purchased this land right after the Revolution and put the fence around the fort. And that was the first act of preservation in our nation. And, you know, just incredible. It's in the early Republic period and quite extraordinary. And Stephen and Sarah's investment and commitment to our nation's history for future generations by reconstructing and restoring the fort was, again, the earliest act of restoration of its kind. You know, to do something of this scale. And so the officers' barracks, about 60% of that stood, and when visitors come today, they can see the lighter mortar in the walls of that barracks, which indicates what was the original walls and then what was the new walls from the 20th century put up on that. That it was the most intact of all of our buildings. Soldiers' barracks, it was the outer walls that still stood. Our Magazine d'Oie, which is now our Mars Education Center, was blown up by the French in 1759, so that was just the foundation, basically, the archaeological remains. So it was a combination of reconstruction and restoration, and that's ongoing. The preservation and recreation of our structures continue, just like other historic places have to do as well. And then across our landscape, we have all of these earthen fortifications that I mentioned earlier. And today, that includes the most intact Revolutionary War earthen fortifications that exist.
Beth Hill is president and CEO of Fort Ticonderoga in Ticonderoga, New York. I know you're the president and CEO. It sounds like it's who operates Fort Ticonderoga today?
So Fort Ticonderoga is owned and operated by the Fort Ticonderoga Association. Our museum founders, Stephen and Sarah Pell, created the nonprofit 501c3 educational organization in the early 1930s. And so it's governed by a board of trustees who are incredible leaders and give significantly to the organization. And they come from across the nation. And then I report to the board chairman, and then the staff, of course, reports to me. So all proceeds, whether it's through our admissions or our cafe or our retail program or boat tours, all of those proceeds go to support our educational mission of preservation and education, and as well as donor support. We have donors from across our nation, and more than 2,000 donors from across our nation and from every state. And we're just so excited and blessed to be able to utilize those resources to not only engage about 75,000 visitors here annually at Fort Ticonderoga, but also to reach more than 430 affiliate schools across our nation and more than 80 universities, and that also includes 8 other nations. So our impact is far and wide, and our mission really focuses on our nation's military heritage and not only learning about it, but also provoking an active discussion related to its meaning to us today.
The Fort Ticonderoga is not a government agency. I know that's clear, but do you seek federal funds or other kinds of grants?
We do, and we're very proud of our museum founders' vision. They specifically articulated that they felt like they could do a better job in serving the educational mission as an independent entity. We enjoy the freedom of being a nonprofit educational organization to be able to be very progressive in how we carry our story forward and create the experience for our visitors. At the same time, you bring up a very good point. It is our responsibility to seek out support in every avenue that we possibly can to best serve this mission and preserve this remarkable place and educate all that we engage. So we do seek special grant funding through the federal government and the state government. We do apply for competitive grants to the New York State Council for the Arts, who does give us annual operating support, and we're very grateful to them for that. The state has been very generous to us recently, particularly supporting some of our capital projects, such as the 1826 Pell Home, the pavilion, which has a restoration and adaptive reuse underway right now. And then we've received a number of very competitive federal grants to support our museum collections work, making our incredible museum holdings accessible to the world through our digital and other online resources.
And Fort Ticonderoga and Mount Defiance are open daily now from May through October for visitations 9:30 to 5, is that correct?
That's correct. We're open 7 days a week, 9:30 to 5, and we have so many wonderful special events lined up for this year. I encourage everybody to visit fortticonderoga.org to check out our event calendar. I like to say every day is an event and every year is a new experience, and we put a lot of work into it, and we absolutely deliver on that for our visitors. So we're excited for everybody to come back and visit time and time again. Also, visitors can get a membership, and that gives them an annual pass as well as helping us serve our incredible mission. So we encourage people to get a membership and come back time and time again and enjoy all that we have to offer across our 2,000 acres.
Beth Hill is president and CEO at Fort Ticonderoga. You've been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.